It's a small, it's a pretty small room, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It was full, though, you know, but as you say, it's good for that reason. I like them a little smaller. As long as they're going to be nightclubs, I like them smaller.
Yeah, I've just been here once before to hear Mort Saul,
mm-hmm.
6 months or something like that ago, and sort of the same reaction. I mean, the same kind of, you know, some things would just completely die and other things.
Right. They're middle-class audiences. They're used to certain roles and attitudes and things both publicly and privately, and they're just stuck with that. That's really one of the things that all the whole thing is about, isn't it?
Right. Playboy.
Yes. It's my last saloon. According to my present plans, I might do Mr. Kelly's once or occasionally or something like that because it is small and you can feel free there. But there aren't many, and I'm going to the campuses and to the coffee houses.
I know. I heard you talk about that on television, I guess.
Right,
a year
some
or so
months ago.
When
right.
you were beginning to...
In fact, I should have had much more happen along those lines by this time, but the people around me, the manager I had at that time, I don't know. He was he didn't think I was serious or something, and he just kind of just didn't pay any attention to it, and I finally had to just change the whole team, as it were, you know, and get guys who were kind of wired into where I want to go and who can get me there. And now that is the case, and we're working hard on it. It still takes time. I have to do the college conferences. They have these regional conferences of bookers from colleges. That they're more or less auditions, which I don't mind doing because I can cover like 80 or 90 colleges at once and have a better chance. But, I'll just have to work up to it and let the word get out that I'm doing things that they like there. That you can't just expect them to want me because I want to go there.
How that one of the things I was going to ask you was how many, you know, in a given engagement like this, for instance, how much do you change your material from one show to the next? I know there's some comedians who will do almost identically the same show after show. There are others who will vary each, even though they do the same things, vary it each time they do it.
one of the things about my current change, which has like been in process for about a year and a half or so, one of those things has been a getting away from a standard set. I used to be a rapper a long time ago and a coffee house comic before television discovered me. Then when they did, I wrote all these little 5 and 6 minute hunks and bits that were really nice little gems, well polished, and my show then in nightclubs became 5 or 6 of these little gems with a few interconnecting lines. Well, I finally got tired of that and couldn't let them grow anymore. It was too rigid, so I began to let myself break through into the material again and have my own personality come out, and that has been part of it. So the answer to your question in a roundabout way is that, yeah, they're different every time. Even some of the set pieces have little variations, but there's a great deal of skeletal framework that I can rely on and certain jokes that I want to be in every show because they're things that I want to say and have heard, you know.
Yeah, but some of it depends on just how you think the audience is going to follow
that line. Absolutely. Yes, now in a gig like this, I came in here last night and realized I couldn't really do what I've been doing lately in the coffee houses. I just felt it would jar the room too much to open with it. It's a routine about what happened to me in Las Vegas when I was censored there. And I just felt what I want to do here with these folks is to win them over and have them dig this new thing I'm doing. And in order to do that, the best thing is to lay the groundwork so that they'll be in that frame. So I changed my opening and kind of, as I say, tried to win them over first and get them confident in me. See, it's an amazing thing. Even with the uptight kind of audiences that you'll find in most nightclubs, if they believe in you, if they really think that you kind of have this love feeling, and I don't mean you go on talking about love, that's the last thing you should do, but they get that feeling, and if they trust you, you can really do almost anything with them. But those first 10 minutes are very crucial, because they're used to making snap judgments, and if they make the wrong one there, it takes you 20 minutes to get them over it.
What did happen in Las Vegas?
In Las Vegas, I said shit in my act, which I had said for 30 days in Las Vegas, and on the 31st day, the wrong person heard it under the wrong circumstances, and I was fired, and not paid either for the remaining time, which you're supposed to be on a pay-or-play contract. The Lord takes a long time, I guess, but Mayhew finally got fired this past few months, and he was the one who did it to me, so it took a while, and I must say I took mine better than he took his, but that's what happened in Las Vegas.
What happened? I also read something in Variety.
Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Right,
Now that was a Playboy club, and that was a slightly different situation. Although basically, underneath it all, they're tied together. It has to do with me trying to break out of the mold and them trying to resist that. In Vegas, it was a matter of a show that wasn't going over well, but it was material I had used all through the run. In Wisconsin, I had only had two nights in the run, but it was also material I had used the night before and on the dinner show. But what happened in Wisconsin was they objected to my political lines. I have things about Muhammad Ali and Vietnam and then Agnew and Nixon and the leadership and everything. And they accepted the Las Vegas story about shit, and they accepted the hair poem, which I have a little poem and a little talk about hair, but they would not go for the other stuff. It turned them off. And instead of just being silent, they got mad and yelled and said all sorts of things, began to get up and ask for their money back. Some were talking, just a lot of them didn't know what to do. They were just making noise and yelling things at me, which I tried to answer, some of them smart-ass, and I tried to answer some of them straight. I tried to struggle for control, you know, and I couldn't certainly go back and do a dopey dance for them. I couldn't go back and do Al Sleet, the hippie dippy weatherman, to try to win them over. I was stuck with what I was doing. So I just kept flailing on, and nothing was working and everything, and then I did my thing about the priorities in this country, and they didn't care for anything, you know. So I left, kind of cool, giving the peace sign, and walked out through the audience so that I didn't want them to think that they had, you know, intimidated me. Although I had to leave, I couldn't continue.
Again, you mentioned the show about Las Vegas. Was it just an excuse to?
No, in Las Vegas, what happened was, most of the nights you have a general audience. Some nights you have special group, 200 from Chrysler Corporation were in that night, 200 or 300 perhaps, and they were all winners of local sales contests in selling cars. Now, if you know anything about car salesmanship, and my brother was in it for a long time, these guys were the deadliest cats at it. Selling cars is burying people under notes and being very ruthless about it, and these were the best ones at that, who were gathered in this nightclub, and I was doing my normal show. But they took exception to it, and a couple of them yelled. One of them yelled, it's not very funny, and or we don't think you're funny, or something like that. And I said, well, do you think I really care about that? And we got into a little dialogue, which was stupid for me to do, but I got into it with them, and it just encouraged them. They were just bullies, and they were somewhat juiced, and they were going to destroy this bearded comic on stage, and they did it. You know, it was kind of mob psychology with them. But because they were offended, the hotel fired me, largely because of the bad manners of the audience. Although, as I say, they told me it was because I said shit. And Buddy Hackett said it every night, and I said it every night for a month, you know.
But the fact that Playboy Club didn't blackball you with...
Hugh Hefner was rather interesting when I told him about it, because I referred him to the Playboy Philosophy section on censorship. Uh-huh. And he said, well, I have two hats. One is half the guy in the audience who would have loved it, and the other is half the businessman that has to deal with these middle-class folks. And so that was his stand. And officially, the company said, well, the clubs are fairly semi-autonomous, and they get, you know, one of them won't hurt you anywhere else. So here I am at San Francisco. I may come back here, too, if over the whole week I really think that I can be allowed to do my thing here. This would be also like a Mr. Kelly's, a place where I would make an exception and like to come occasionally for a week.
Yeah, I'm wondering what there is around here, you know. Colleges, yes.
Well, it would have to be, yeah.
Coffee houses, I don't
really
know.
There's no money in coffee houses, but you can, of course, make up for that in concert situations. The concert situation is such a much better paying thing than nightclubs that you can afford to really do some coffee houses to keep your chops and to keep that good communication level in a smaller room that is so much fun, really, for me. So you can kind of balance it off that way and get them both done.
There's certainly, in Berkeley, a community theater there has something probably three or four times a week.
Yeah.
Good stuff coming through.
I'm just going to keep getting into those places and let the word get around. Of course, the material has to develop. I've only, for two or three months now, been really actively working toward writing material and doing material that is about today, about the truth, about what's going down. And I know from my past experience that given a year of this kind of concentration and attention that I'm really going to have, this is immodest, but it's true, I'm really going to have some fire out and find things that I'll be doing. And so I know that as a year or so goes by, a lot of it will snowball, and I can get some of these things. Right now, I don't have a single concert to tell you about, but I intend to have them.
Just to bounce back a little bit, what you were on a summer television series, what, year before
in 60,
last?
In 66 I was in...
Was it that long ago?
Yes, and in 67 I was co-host of one. One was with John Davidson and one was with Buddy Greco.
Yeah, how...
67.
How did that fit into your development? What kind of material did you do then? Did you do the little 5 and 6 minute
yes.
bits that you
what
were talking
What was happening
about?
To me then was that I was in the midst of that. I had the Merv Griffin Show broke me loose in 65 with my Indian Sergeant, the newscast, Wonderful Wino, daytime television, and the commercials bits. And they were all groovy, and they became, as I say, my nightclub act. And then when I would go on variety guest shots, I would do one of them. And I would, the news and the Wino were always able to change and grow a little. The others were kind of stuck. I kept then going into television. That became my specialty. Well, I'll be the guy who makes fun of TV. That was what I thought to myself. That'll be a way to go. A comic needs an identity. So I went after all the various shows. It even got to the point when I had exhausted so many of them that I did a thing on the late night prisoners where they show the FBI list of wanted men. I did a whole takeoff on that, what it would look like if they jazzed it up as a variety show and called it the J. Edgar Hoover Show, and they showed you the guy's picture and they did a song and everything. But, I mean, that's how far I took television. And it was fun doing all of those things. But eventually, of course, even though there were a million different parts of television to satirize, it all began to sound the same to me. That was the middle of that period then was 67 when the network put me on during the summer with Buddy Greco and Buddy Rich taking Gleason's place. And they gave us these writers from the 19th century.
Oh, that's part of the deal.
These old guys, yeah, who I had to fight all summer. I had to do a little bit of their things, improved somewhat, and I'm very frank about those things. I think I do this well, and I think some other guys I've seen don't, and I'm honest about it. And I had to change a lot, but I survived this. It was weird, because Buddy Greco and Buddy Rich are both kind of like, if you know what I mean, killer guys, man. They're very heavyweight kind of personality guys, man. And for me, as a new comic and a youngster in the business and all that, it was really just to stay alive was good that summer.
What about records?
I have one album from 3 years ago, which I'm happy to say still stands up, man, and I'm doing another one now. I was originally planning to do some in the studio because I have a lot of things I want to do that don't require audiences or nightclub situation. They're just funny things to put on, like Fire Sign
does
their kind of things. Well, I had some things in mind like that, but now I've decided the next one should be my act again because the act has changed so much because I want to get all these new things onto it. So the next album, which I should have done in about 2 months and out in about 3, will be what I'm doing now in the clubs. I have I have the whole thing planned in my mind. Then after that, I want to kind of goof around with it.
How do you go about now choosing what you're going to do and working on it?
You just let all of the things that happen during the day bombard you, and the ones from your experience, from my own experience as a comic, I know which ones perhaps, in some cases, I know which ones are fruitless to follow, but then there are others where I know that's good. I keep a lot of notes, but I edit frequently and I throw out things that I would think of anyway. The only thing I save is something I would never think of again. I found that out. You can save a lot of things that you would normally think of again and you don't need. You say, what's that? You say, well, I would have thought of that if I was writing that. Throw it away. But I have a little hand recorder and I keep the ideas because they really, it's like a file. You can go to the folder and say, all right, I got a folder. I got a lot of lines on drugs in here, and I'm gonna write my drug bit, and I'll just look at all these lines I've had over the last year, and I'll think about it more, and it really works.
One of the things, I guess it was a couple of years ago, it just struck me watching a Bob Hope television show, at how much television commercials have influenced the language. I mean, it seemed to me practically every joke in that show was just a twist on some
familiar advertising
phrase,
slogan
from a commercial, and it seems to me a pretty bankrupt.
Yeah, what I always tried to do with it was just to be the best at it. I mean, I knew everybody was making fun of commercials, but there was a good reason for it. It's a great common denominator. It's a thing where everyone in your audience will agree with your position. They mostly hate them and dislike them for various reasons. And so that's an obvious reason for comics to go for them. But I always tried to keep my comments cut above the ordinary. I guess everyone feels that way, but I still have things about deodorants that I get into. But now, instead of imitating TV commercials about deodorants, I'm really talking about the American hang-up on odors and how that reflects our puritanical backgrounds, and it's really a lot more fun. Meanwhile, I get all the familiar commercial things done for their heads,
Yeah, I was really, I wasn't reflecting on what you were doing, but just the fact that, I don't think it was so much the fact that it was making fun of a commercial, but just using something familiar to get a laugh by putting it in a different situation.
Right.
It got to be such a tired thing.
Yeah.
It seemed to me the writers couldn't think of anything new, but giving a a twist to, you know, using a formula, which I guess most of those, as you refer to the 19th century,
I'm really amazed that there are new young writers around TV. The Smothers helped some new ones get going, and Carol Burnett has a couple of younger people on their staff, and there are some younger people, but there are also these guys who have been doing it for so long, and all I want to do is tell you stories. You know, one thing I hate about show business people, and the reason I don't hang around with them mostly, is because they always want to tell you stories. All they ever want to do is tell you some story that happened, and even if it's not a famous guy in it, they want to tell you this, and they want to hear themselves talk. And I get so tired of that, man. And that's the way these writers were. They want to tell you about how, this time Milton Berle, he didn't like the sketch, you know? Well, we had this sketch, and Milton didn't like it. Well, Milton says, I don't like it, you know what I mean? Well, anyway, it's just really such a bother.
Is it difficult for young writers to get in the business like it is for, say, in film directors? Are there union and guild problems? Or
I don't think, the problems are in, there are so few spots, and there are so many probably that would like to be heard. And then again, whoever knows when guys are being hired for that? You know, like if there's a fall show coming up, the average person who wanted to break in wouldn't really know how to do it. The only thing that happens is like a Smothers comes along, or Rowan and Martin's, or somewhere where they say, okay, cool, we're hiring young creative people, we're going to build them and grow with them and all that. There is more of that, fortunately. There are better situations.
Maybe this is a corny question, but are there any comedians who have influenced you, or the people you really dug when you were young?
Yeah, and I have like different sets of them. My first set of comedian that I liked and influenced me, I think, were like Danny Kaye in the movies, Spike Jones on records, the Marx Brothers in the movies, then Martin and Lewis. Now that starts a new era of, I was a little older, Martin and Lewis, and then that leads into like Ernie Kovacs, Bob and Ray.
Oh, yeah.
And then that leads into Jonathan Winters, Lenny Bruce, Mort Saul, Lord Buckley. There are a lot of guys that don't do especially inventive or great original comedy that I like because they make me laugh, too. You know, I mean, I kind of tend to want to hear new things and guys that are really doing something different and saying something. But I'm also an ordinary human being who laughs at funny things when a good comic gets on. So there are guys like that who do it to me, you know. But Lenny Bruce and Mort Saul were very influential early on when I had a partner, Jack Burns, who later went with Avery Schreiber.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Well, Jack and I had a team, and Mort helped get us started, and Lenny helped us. Lenny got us our first agency contract. I used to do an impression of Lenny and Mort in the act 10 years ago. Mm. I did my Lenny and Mort, and they came in to see it, and so they helped us a little. And I kind of tried to stay in touch with Lenny and knew him a little bit. I knew his mother a little better, I think. Sally, she's funny. And they always had a strong influence. I always felt that was eventually what I'd like to do, even while I was detoured into the other thing, and I was trying to find out and test the limits and see how much TV would let me do, where they'd let me go, would they give me my show. Now I've come around to where I can at least talk about some of the same subjects Mort and Lenny talked about, and I'd love to accomplish some of the things that Lenny set out to accomplish, that is, to make people more comfortable with themselves. That's really all it is.
I think in a way a lot of that has happened.
Oh, indeed, yeah. And it's such a shame that Lenny didn't just arrive at this period now, the 68, 69, 70.
Certainly in San Francisco, from what I've seen, at least there's not the taboo about words and
right.
language, and people don't get arrested for saying things
right.
like he did. Did you grow up in New York?
Yeah, Upper West Side of Manhattan, around Harlem, Columbia University, Juilliard. Good influences, good childhood vibes, a lot of good people kind of people, a lot of strong funk. And we were into some of the agriculture situation, which is only recently, I was a teenager in 52. Let's see, in 52 I was 15 years old. And I had smoked grass 2 years before that. So that what I'm trying to say to you is that it was a neighborhood that, even though it was that long ago, the neighborhood was into grass, I'm happy to say.
And where did you
Oh,
begin
I quit
working?
High school. Quit high school at 17. I wanted to be an actor, comedian, imitator. I didn't know what. I knew that disc jockeying could help me get there. My mother had got me a tape recorder, and I worked with it a lot. And I really dug production and speaking, you know. And I quit high school so that I could, again, the same kind of reasons that you hear about today, man. It was irrelevant. It was boring. And I was beyond much of the work, and there was it had nothing to do with the world I was going into, and so I left, man. And I went in the Air Force, figuring when I got out, at that time, of course, you didn't shirk your draft thing yet. Unfortunately, that wasn't part of the thinking of young people at that time. To me, what I was doing was getting my Air Force over so they wouldn't draft me at 22. That was the problem in New York. They had so many cats that you didn't get drafted until 22 or 3, right when you were getting it on. So I wanted to do it up and get it over with, and I went in the Air Force. My mother signed me, and instead of having to wait till I got out to go on the GI Bill for disc jockey school, I found a station while I was in that let me work down in Louisiana. I worked off base at a number one top 40 station, so I was 18 when I started my jock career, and I still stayed 2 years in the Air Force. So I got a lot done at the same time. When I got out, I was 20, and I had 2 years in radio, and I had my service obligation out of the way, as we called it. It's such a funny phrase, my service obligation. Right, anyway. And then the disc jockeying was for 4 years, and that led to meeting a guy on radio, Jack Burns, funny cat, and we were funny together, so we said, hey, let's do a team. And we did that for 2 years. And then I became a single in 62 at the Gator Horn.
When you mentioned what kinds of things you can do on television, what kinds of things have you been not allowed to do?
Well, it's not so much that. Of course, there is that. What I really meant when I said that was there's no place to experiment on television. I'd like to do a kind of a variety talk, information, comedy show that is really very a kind of a very different format and a very loose thing that they wouldn't ever bother to take a gamble with. And then especially CBS wanted me to do a series for like a year or so, and we, as they say, we looked around for an idea and a property and tried to develop something, and this was my last fling with them. I was going to say, well, let's see if they'll really do something that I want to do. And we tried one thing about a guy who managed a small radio station, and it didn't work. And then what happened was Mary Tyler Moore and Andy Griffith and Dick Van Dyke all announced at once they were coming back to television. And guess where that put me on the list at CBS? So I said, well, screw that. I didn't really want to do that anyway, and I was just kind of hoping. So let me go ahead and finish, you know, growing and be who I am. That's when I went ahead and I grew my beard and decided to say more in my act. It was really like a decision that had been smoldering a while, and that gave me a chance to go ahead and do it.
You know, CBS seems to be about the least original of the networks as far as trying out something new. They usually want to try something tried and true.
Bandwagonsville, right? If you can come up with something about, it's amazing how the country or hillbilly, whatever you want to call that particular thing, how that dominates so much television, and especially at CBS. When you think of Hee Haw, Glen Campbell, and Petticoat Junction and Green Acres and Beverly Hillbillies, there's really a lot of it, man. I could never make fun of television anymore because I can't stand to watch it.
I was going to say, when you were doing these imitations, you must have watched an awful lot.
Yeah, I always, when I do watch, you know that thing about watching a campy movie or an old movie
bad.
Yeah. Well, I watch most of television really thinking about how terribly, like Amateur Night at High School, most of it is. It's sad because it's such a fantastic invention, man. A thing comes into your home, it tells you stuff and shows you pictures, and look what we've done with it. We haven't done anything with it. Incredible. That'll change. Hopefully that will change if things stay together long enough, because satellites and cable TV and demand broadcasting and one other factor, cassettes. Right?
Yeah, well, I was thinking of CATV, you know, when you were talking about what you wanted to do. Maybe that's a possibility. Of course, it's moving so that the same people who own and control the networks now are moving to control that medium too.
Right.
And cassettes, of course, there are so many different things planned, but CBS's plan is, again, something that they will control because they make and distribute them. It's not a thing you can do in your at home, although I guess there will be that kind of
home
stuff.
I think there'll be less and less ability of large groups of anything to control stuff as the years go along, unless we all get wiped out.
I mean, it's really, when you think about it, that's really what happened to radio. It turned into records, and everybody can't do an album. At least it's a lot easier for someone to do an album than it would have been for them to get a radio show.
Right, right, absolutely.
I don't know, what do you think is the biggest problem in America? Is that an unfair question?
It's, I guess it's fair. The biggest problem is values. That's all. The newer kind of human beings that are being born during this technological rush are indeed newer types of human beings, and their values are different, and there's a real terrible clash because so many people are still alive. In other words, the change came so quickly in technology and in what has happened to the planet and the people that there are now, at the same time alive, people with vast different experiences. It used to be many lifetimes would go by before a father and son had different experiences. Now it's an incredibly different experience, a father and a son and a son and a son, within 40 years, like, it's fantastic. So the big problem is the values that are being threatened by that, and many of them should be, obviously. and then there are some that probably shouldn't disappear altogether. The big problem is deciding which ones we want to retain, I think.
What kind of material about Nixon do you use in your act?
I must say that as far as Nixon himself is concerned, I haven't really gotten in to him. It's more been things about things about the Vietnam shtick in general, and then I refer to him insofar as he is he's now the guy who has to, you know, do the thing. The things I've developed the most up to now, which are new and which are kind of, what are we talking about, this kind of comedy? Social satire, social commentary, whatever, are a drug rap, a thing about values and conspicuous consumption concerning what we sell in novelty stores. We sell fake vomit and we sell little pieces of dog crap, and there are people who have to walk by that don't have enough food that day, you know, and there's a long thing about it, and how do you sell and buy dog crap, and some of the theory that must go into it. And there is stuff about hair, clay, Vietnam. You heard some of these things tonight, somewhat edited in some cases, because the folks here don't really, I don't know whether it is whether they don't understand or don't like, but there are certain things that I'm just best avoiding while I'm here.
What about films?
Yeah, I'd like to write them.
Have you done? That's another question.
I did one.
Have you written for?
No, I haven't done any writing outside of my own material. But I have a film I'm writing now. I hope someone will like it and make it sometime. You know, when I finish it, it's not a thing I can do every day because I'm trying to get this other thing working. But when I can, I work on it. I'd like to do that eventually. Write a film, a play, a couple of films, a book that can turn into a film. I've really found out in the last 2 years that the thing I enjoy most is writing these ideas out. Delivering them from a stage is second to that. It's nice to be able to deliver your own material, but it's so much better now, I've found, to be able to sit and write it. The thing I want most is to say how I feel, not so much out loud as just to have it written out. And I don't know, I'm 33. If I could do my comedy thing for 5 or 6 or 7 more years and really feel I had gotten a lot of that out of my system on stage and everything, then I could really concentrate on writing and have a career at that. And it's the most independent thing you can do it anywhere in the world, and that's what I love about it. And those would be my general plans. I really do want to try this concert thing and try to establish that reputation and do it for several years and really just be able to do it for nice audiences and groovy, nice heads and big audiences, you know. But I know I'll tire of that, and then I think the answer will be writing only.
Judging by material I saw, even though the audience didn't take it too well tonight,
yeah,
take it all in, I think you've got a good future in that, in that line.
Thank you. Yeah, I got to just keep working. But it's fun work. You know, that's the nice thing. What's your job? Oh, thinking up funny stuff. What a great job. So I'm at least happy in that, you know, and then as I get to say it, crazy.
I hope that you get a chance to come back to San Francisco. Maybe you can, you know, and have a place where you can say it and are received well.
Good. Well, thank you. I'll be looking forward to it. It's certainly one place that I won't want to miss, right? Yeah. I was driving around today, and I went up to Mount Tam, and I was over to the beach and looking around and everything. So good for you here, man. It really is. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.